Word of mouth.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for Word of Mouth Civics 101 series, the No Shame podcast refresher course on some basics that you may have forgotten since middle school. Last month, a trio of judges on a federal appeals court upheld a freeze on the Trump administration's immigration order. Some people celebrated, the administration protested, and a number of people said, wait a minute, how did this happen? How do the federal courts work? Today on Civics 101, the structure and power of the federal courts, what they can do, how they do it, and why it matters. Aaron Corcoran is a professor at the University of New Hampshire School of Law and serves on the New Hampshire Supreme Court's Access to Justice Commission. Aaron, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
So glad you're here. Because I need like the Constitution for Kids version. Do you mind?
Sure.
Okay.
So there's three main levels to the federal judiciary. The first is the district court level, which is the trial court level. And there's 94 federal district courts in the United States. From there, there's what we refer to as an intermediate appellate level, which is comprised of 13 circuit court jurisdictions. And 12 of those have geographical reach. So, for example, if you're in New Hampshire, you would appeal to the First Circuit. And from there, all of those circuits, then you can appeal those decisions up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
All right. So I might even have to go more Constitution for Kids. Trial court and an appeals or an appellate court. What's the difference there?
Sure. So trial courts hear the questions of for the first time, and they're primarily concerned with working through the facts of the case, trying to understand what the different issues are and developing sort of a timeline, a sequence of events, what happens, and then also what kind of legal recourse the parties may have. If you don't like that decision, either party in the civil law context can ask for the appellate court to review the decision of the district court.
Okay, so the trial court would look like what we have in the vision of a trial, right, that we see on television.
Sure, you would have lawyers on either side. Usually you have a jury. People are called up to testify. It's sort of what, you know, you see in Law and Order on TV. That's a trial court.
And if they're not happy, they say, we're appealing this decision. It goes to the appellate court.
Right. And that appeal is less dramatic. Most of that work is done before they actually present the case to the court. And it's all done with written briefs. And then the court may have what's called an oral argument, an opportunity for each party to give an oral submission of their legal arguments to the appellate body.
I'm still not exactly clear on what their jurisdiction is. There are various and sundry different jurisdictions.
Sure. So a federal court is a court of limited jurisdiction, and they basically have jurisdiction over constitutional questions, and then other questions.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. First Amendment.
Yeah.
Does this law violate my First Amendment rights, my right to freedom of speech, freedom of association? A federal district court would be the court that would hear that claim. They also can hear claims, what we refer to as federal question claims. This is sort of Congress saying, if this question is about federal law, you know, whether or not an agency has the authority to do something, that would be another example of the kind of question that court could hear.
How are federal judges appointed?
They are nominated by the President of the United States.
Every single one?
Every single one, and confirmed by the Senate. And for federal judges and circuit court judges, the current rule in the Senate is they need to have 51 or more votes in favor of them.
All right. So what is the difference between a district and circuit court in terms of power? Or hierarchy, maybe. Is that a better way to ask?
Sure. I mean, so the district court generally is looking at issues affecting the parties within their district, although, as we have seen in recent cases, they do have the power to make decisions or issue orders that can affect the entire country. The circuit courts are only hearing appeals that are coming from district courts in their circuit. So, for example, if a New Hampshire judge's decision was appealed to the First Circuit and a California or Washington State judge's decision was appealed to the Ninth Circuit, the Ninth and First Circuit could, in theory, have come up with different rulings. And that would be what we refer to as a circuit split, where there's disagreement among the circuits. And so the decision by the First Circuit would be what everyone living in the First Circuit would have to abide by, and those in the Ninth Circuit would have to abide by the Ninth Circuit ruling.
And the Supreme Court loves circuit splits. Have I got that right?
That's correct. That's one of the main, one of the decision points in deciding which cases they're going to take on, since they take on so few.
Is there any difference in the sort of sway or power of, you know, a larger circuit compared to another, the First Circuit compared to the Ninth, or, you know, the 11th versus the Fifth?
There's definitely, in some ways, a more sway with the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the Circuit Court of Appeals that hears cases coming out of the District of Columbia, in part because many of the cases around the power that the federal government has is litigated in those courts.
So D.C. versus Heller, for example, that fed up to the Supreme
Exactly.
Court.
And the judges that sit on that circuit oftentimes are judges that are elevated to the Supreme Court. I think with respect to the different circuits, because they are regionally based and geographically based, reflexively, their opinions will be different, sort of in part based on sort of what kind of cases come up through them. So, for example, as an immigration lawyer, when I practiced, we knew that which circuit courts tended to have more favorable outcomes for non-citizens. Not always, but if you were sort of looking statistically, you were much better off bringing a case for a non-citizen in the Ninth Circuit or the Second Circuit as opposed to the Fifth or the Fourth.
So you would try and get your case heard in particular places for particular outcomes?
Well, I think you in some ways you're limited by where you have to be
in
within the jurisdiction of the federal district
right.
court to bring a case, and then that determines where you go. But in counseling clients about whether or not it was in their interest to appeal a case or what the odds were of succeeding on the merits if they were to appeal the case, we certainly looked at, you know, geographically where what court they would be appearing before.
All right. So we haven't even talked about the Supreme Court necessarily yet. How do they feed up to the Supreme Court through the district or circuit court level?
So once they've gone to through the circuit court level, a party can appeal and ask as a matter of discretion that the Supreme Court take on that case. That party would file what would be known as a petition for certiorari to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court votes on whether or not to hear that petition. And then if they decide to hear that petition, they will then schedule a briefing schedule and oral arguments for that. So they are only taking up a very small percentage of the cases that are asked, that ask for that review. And they're looking for reasons such as either a novel area of the law that's never been decided before, or, as you mentioned, a circuit split.
Okay. So what is the role of the federal court system in the checks and balances between Congress, judiciary, and executive?
Sure. So generally speaking, the courts don't like to get involved in actions that the president or Congress are taking, usually because those are often seen as political questions. So if you don't like what Congress is doing or you don't like what the president's doing, generally speaking, the check is at the ballot box. You get to vote those people out of office at the next election. However, there are times in which either branch of government may be overstepping their constitutionally prescribed limits. And that is when the court has a vital role in checking that power to say, you, president, don't have that power under the Constitution, and we're going to stop you from doing that because it does violate the Constitution.
We have heard much about the temporary restraining order on Trump's immigration executive order. It was first issued by a district court judge, then later upheld by a three-judge panel in the Ninth Circuit. It's a really complicated case, and I don't think that we want to dig into it any more than it's already happened, and it's bound to move quickly. But in order for this judge to initially issue a temporary restraining order, there was an actual case, like a trial for that?
A temporary restraining order is a very modest measure. I like to think of it as the pause button on your VCR,
mm-hmm.
or so the trial starts, but before the trial really gets started, you want to preserve the status quo, right? So this executive order was new policy, lots of changes, not sure if it's constitutional or not. And so the Washington Attorney General was simply asking, can we just put that policy on hold for a short period of time until we figure out sort of if this is actually a good policy? Because we don't want to have to then go back and undo everything that the policy did if, in fact, the policy is unconstitutional. So it's before you even get to trial, you're basically asking the judge, just hit the pause button And you have to show, in order to get a temporary restraining order, that there's a success on the likelihood of the merits. And the other thing that you have to show is that there would be irreparable harm to the person who wants it. So in Brooklyn, in the first TRO that was issued, one of the men that was coming was an interpreter for the U.S. military who was on a special visa given to him by the military because they were afraid he would be harmed or killed because he was supporting the U.S. military. So to send him back, even if it ultimately we found out the executive order was unconstitutional, the harm that could have occurred to him before that ultimate decision or that trial decision came out.
So a case has to be brought to a court for a judge to issue a temporary restraining order.
Right. So you file a complaint, and in the complaint you allege all of the things you think that the other party has done wrong, why you think this court is the proper court to hear the case, and what you'd like the court to do for you. Once that complaint is filed, you can also file a motion for a temporary restraining order.
So to continue the analogy, then the administration came and said, press play.
Right.
And the three-judge panel came in and said, no, keep the pause button
yes,
on.
Yes, exactly.
And so now it goes possibly to the Supreme Court?
Correct.
What do you think is the most important thing that listeners, citizens, should know or take away from the federal court system?
That the court's responsibility is to interpret what the law says. It's not to make new law. It's not to decide cases by whether a judge thinks something is morally right or wrong. Oftentimes when I've talked with judges, they are confined and limited by the four corners of the statute and the four corners of the Constitution. And so sometimes they have to make decisions that they don't like, but they're upholding their oath to uphold the Constitution and to interpret the law. And I think sometimes people think that the courts have more power than that.
Erin Corcoran, she's a professor at the University of New Hampshire School of Law. She teaches classes on immigration law and administrative process. Thank you so much for walking me through.
Thank you, Virginia.
Maybe creeping me through. This episode of Civics 101 was produced by Taylor Quimby and edited by Maureen McMurray. You can call in or text your own questions to the Civics 101 hotline. That's 202-798-6865. Who knows? Your question might just inspire a new episode.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The success of a species is based on two things, procreating and staying alive. Or as Mara Hart put it in her book, Sex in the Sea, getting busy and not getting eaten. Although she uses an even racier term for the former. New technologies are allowing marine researchers to get more detailed information on how the life cycle churns beneath the waves. Hart brings us on a bold ride through the red light district of the deep blue sea, where polyamorous right whales, libidinous lobsters, swinging groupers, and other creatures conduct elaborate mating rituals in the place where life began, the ocean. While it may sound smutty, it is science, and Hart makes the case that humans play a critical role in sustaining a sex-positive environment in the world's oceans. Mara is a coral reef ecologist and research co-director for Future of Fish. I spoke to her when the book first came out. It's now in paperback. So voyeurism aside, why should we be interested in what sex looks like in the sea?
It's a fair question, and really the answer is pretty simple. Sex and successful sex, leading to reproduction, is the heart of sustainability. So sex is what drives all the abundance that feeds the fish that feed us. It's what allows for the prolific procreation of oysters that build giant reefs that provide food and shoreline protection. It's what allows corals to build their own giant reefs that provide medicine and habitat for countless species, including us. Without that kind of sex, we don't have diversity and we don't have the amazing bounty that we all rely on.
Well, let's talk about some of these tiny building blocks. And it starts with locating a mate. And in the case of copepods, these little creatures that can be tiny as sesame seeds, how do they find each other in this vast, vast sea?
Yeah, not only are they tiny, but some of them only live a few weeks to a few months. So the clock is ticking for them to be able to find one another. And researcher Jeanette Yen explained it to me this way. She's out of Georgia Tech University and noted that they go to singles bars in the ocean. And these are areas where there are boundary layers. So if you think of the ocean as more like a layer cake, there's warm layers and cold layers, saltier layers and fresher layers. And all of these different parts of the ocean stack up, and where they meet is a boundary layer. And in that layer, copepods are sensitive enough to be able to detect the calm space in between these two portions of ocean. And in that calm space, they're able to swim around and concentrate their numbers. So that's the first thing that they can do, is by meeting in these thin areas, they're reducing the total area that they have to look for one another. But because copepods are really, really small, water feels very different for them. It's more like what it would feel like for us if we swam through a giant pool of molasses. It's really thick. And so as a copepod swims, it's actually pushing the water out in front of it and leaving a long trail behind. And males can detect these trails of the females. And the female sometimes will even help the male out by sort of squirting some pheromones into that trail and creating a scented corridor. And as soon as the male hits one of these trails, he can hone in and zoom up the trail to find the female.
These are calm varieties of singles bars.
Right. Very zen singles bars.
Well, blue whales, they have a little more to work with. They emit deep, berry white deep, as you put it, baritone sounds. How does that help them find mates?
So sound travels really far and really well in the ocean, far better than it does through the air. So all whales, not just blue whales, but many species of whales, the males will use sound to navigate, to find and communicate with other individuals in their pods or across ocean regions. We now know that whales off of New England can be literally communicating with a whale in Bermuda. So they can cover vast distances. And what researchers have found with blue whales has been really interesting. Across the world, over the last 30 to 40 years, they've been lowering and lowering the songs, the pitch of their songs. So again, yeah, they're going deep like Barry White does. And this was strange because we were trying to figure out, you know, why would there be this, you know, universal drop, right? Nobody's coordinating this kind of effect. What could be going on? And what happened with blue whales was back in the 20th century, they were severely overhunted. The populations in Antarctica, for example, were decimated by over 95%. So if you were a blue whale trying to find a mate, your odds were pretty low. They were scattered far and wide. So at that point in time, blue whales were singing at a frequency that would allow their songs to travel as far and loud as possible, right? Their main concern was just finding a mate. But over recent years, in a wonderful story of recovery since the moratorium on whaling has gone into effect, the blue whale numbers are going up. And while we don't know that this is exactly the cause, that this is our best guess right now, is that as these numbers have gone up, the males aren't as concerned with finding a mate as they are with seducing that mate. Hmm. And we know that across the animal kingdom, females dig a deeper voice.
So once they find each other, of course, there is the consummation. Deep voice is one seductive thing. Lobsters, not particularly romantic. Sex for them means, I think as you put it, peeing in your lover's face. What?
They can be romantic. So they're sort of this cool combination of kinky and tender. And it's not what you would think of looking at them. But with lobsters, what happens is the male is very aggressive during mating season. He's a big brute. And he uses his pee to intimidate other males. And he'll go around and spray his urine into the dens of neighboring males and sort of work his way in there to show just who's boss. And all of that urine sort of swishing around in the ocean starts to attract females. And the females are attracted to the most dominant male. And this is because females want to know that they are going to be protected during and after mating. So the best time for lobsters to mate is right after a female molts. This is when she loses her shell, and as part of the shell on the underside of her tail, there's a sperm receptacle. This is where the male places the sperm. And when she molts, any leftover sperm will go out the door along with that old shell, and a new receptacle will form. So for the female, mating right after a molt means she can fill up her stores of sperm and be able to fertilize multiple batches of eggs before she has to molt again. For the male, it means he doesn't have to worry that there's already sort of a half full receptacle there. He can fill the entire thing all with his own sperm. What this means, though, is that when a female molts, she's a soft-bodied animal. That shell is normally her armor and her strength. And right after molting, she can't even stand up. She's just like a big jelly blob. And so she's extremely vulnerable. And again, these males are extremely aggressive. So it's a very dangerous situation for her. So what she does is she uses her pee as a magic love potion. And by spraying a male in the face for a few days in a row, the female will approach his den, give a little squirt, and then kind of beat it out of there before he has a chance to retaliate. This urine tends to have a seductive effect. It's an aphrodisiac. And the male becomes calmer and starts to show signs that he's actually interested in mating. He will invite that female in, and then he sort of stays in this entranced, very lover-friendly state for up to a week, waiting for the female to molt. And they pee each other this whole time. They'll stroke each other with the antenna. They'll also touch each other with their feet. And lobsters' taste buds are on their feet. So they're actually like licking each other with their feet. Then the female will molt. And she gives the male this really cool sign that Professor Yael Etema, who's at Boston University, he nicknamed this knighting, because the female will circle in front of the male, pee in his face, and then the male will sort of put his big claws down in the sand. He'll bow his head down, and then she'll lift one of her big claws and tap him on one shoulder and then the other shoulder, just like you would see in a knighting ceremony. And it's this signal that she's saying, all right, don't leave me now, baby. It's about to happen. Let's get it on. And then the male will go over and very gently, very delicately, he will actually lift her up and cradle her in his arms, because again, she can't stand on her own. And he holds her on her back so that they're belly to belly, and the mating process then proceeds.
The love lives of lobsters, one of the things we're learning about from Mara Hart. She's author of Sex in the Sea, which covers the sometimes kinky, sometimes salty, intimate lives of the creatures of the deep and our intimate connection with them. Well, Mara, we're talking about, you know, singles bars, knighting, Barry White. I'm sure listeners notice that we are anthropomorphizing, you know, we're attributing human
yes.
characteristics to animals or vice versa, which is the essential premise in this book. This is something that some scientists frown upon. Have you gotten any pushback on this?
I expect to. Yeah. You know, it was a conscious choice. And the idea for this book came out of a deep desire to break out from the usual norm of how we talk about conservation and ocean management and really try to get the attention and stir up the curiosity of folks who don't normally think about oceans and aren't aware of some of the issues they face. The best way that I could think of to help folks feel a connection was to try to draw these analogies and paint the picture in as human terms and as relatable terms as possible. And there is a little warning at the beginning that, you know, everything in here is meant to be taken with a grain of salt, so to speak. It is based on absolute science, but yes, the phrases and terminologies and some of the assumed personalities that are going into these animals are, of course, out of my own imagination to try to get folks to think a little bit differently about these creatures and be able to relate to what seems like such a foreign and alien space.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the critical nature of what's going on with the oceans. You spoke to a number of researchers who study reproductive habits of marine species and note changes over the last century. And we know, you know, there's a lot more human-generated waste in the ocean than there was a century ago. Also, climate change is affecting life in the oceans. But you spent a lot of time talking about overfishing. Tell us about how that impacts the reproductive lives of ocean creatures.
Sure. So overfishing affects species in a number of different ways. We know for decades now that we have been taking out more fish than the oceans are able to replace. And part of that is because of the reproductive habits. So one example I like to point out is in many fish populations, an individual fish changes sex over the course of its lifetime. For example, in some grouper species, they'll start as females and mate as a female when they're small. And then when they're big enough to take over and sort of dominate a harem, they'll change to be male. And there's a lot of reproductive benefit that can come from that. But you can also imagine that fishers tend to like the biggest fish. That tends to be what we go for. So in these species, when we are fishing, if we are fishing out all the biggest individuals, not only are we reducing the number of individuals in the population, but we are also skewing the sex ratio. So we might be leaving enough folks in the sea. We might be leaving enough of those groupers. But if they're all female, that creates a big problem.
Well, I'd like to dig into overfishing a little bit because you make the point, of course, both biology and behavior play into how much pressure a species can take before it can't replace numbers from its populations. So if we are trying to create a sea environment where the sex lives of creatures are not stressed out, are there more sex-friendly choices we can make in seafood?
Absolutely. And I love the phrase of sex-friendly seafood. That's what we should all be going for. And so there are. So some species have very fast reproductive cycles. And these tend to be species that live lower down on the food web. So sardines and mackerels and anchovies. Also, shellfish like oysters and mussels and clams are incredibly prolific and can withstand a fair amount of harvest if we manage them well. So those are all great options. What we want to also try to do is alleviate the pressure that we put on really the top species that we tend to always go to: salmon, shrimp, tuna. We tend to be very boring eaters, at least in North America. And getting a little bit more adventurous is a good idea in the sense that it just disperses some of that pressure. There are wonderful species that fishers are catching all the time that are sort of lumped into this quote-unquote bycatch, meaning it's accidental that they're being caught. But many of them are perfectly healthy, wonderful protein sources. Redfish and pollock in the Atlantic are some examples. And they would make for fantastic protein and, again, give fishers an income, but take some of the pressure off of those species that are constantly being, you know, hammered all the time. So being a little bit more adventurous and eating lower on the food chain are great ways to help promote more sex-friendly seafood.
Mara Hart, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mara Hart, an ecologist and research co-director for Future of Fish. You'll find a link for more information on her book, Sex in the Sea, which is now out in paperback. Thank you for joining us as we probed the sea and the senses and civics on Word of Mouth. Music in this episode came to us from Blue Dot Sessions, Franco Luzzi, Poddington Bear, and Ketza. There's always a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And to find our podcast, just search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or Google Play. And please rate the podcast on iTunes. That helps other people find us, you know, when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.